Hey, this is Greg Little from Bethany Baptist Church. I'm so thankful that you decided to join us on this podcast. I trust that the Lord will use it in your life to encourage you, strengthen you, and challenge you wherever you are in your walk with Him. For more information about Bethany, you can visit us online at bethanybc.ca. And now let's open our hearts and minds to what the Lord has for us. Matthew 20, we're going to start reading in verse number 17 and read down here to the end of this chapter. So when you found it, we'll start reading in verse number 17 of Matthew chapter 20. And Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples apart in the way and said unto them, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him, and the third day he shall rise again. Then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshipping him and desiring a certain thing of him. And he said unto her, What wilt thou? She saith unto him, Grant that these my two sons may sit, the one on thy right hand and the other on thy left, in thy kingdom. And Jesus answered and said, Ye know not what ye ask. Are ye able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of, and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? They say unto him, We are able. And he saith unto them, Ye shall drink indeed of my cup, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit at my right hand and my left, it is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brethren. But Jesus called them unto him and said, Ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. And as they departed from Jericho, a great multitude followed him. And behold, two blind men sitting by the wayside, when they heard that Jesus passed by, cried out, saying, Have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. And the multitude rebuked them, because they should hold their peace. But they cried the more, saying, Have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. And Jesus stood still and called them and said, What will ye that I shall do unto you? They say unto him, Lord, that our eyes may be open. So Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight, and they followed him. And we'll stop our reading there as we finish up this chapter. Now, as we begin this morning, let me start this way. How many of you have watched all the Star Wars movies from the beginning to the end? All right, I'm not talking about all the extras. It's okay, you can admit it. I know we're in church this morning. You can admit that you watched some Star Wars. But I mean like from episode 1 all the way to episode 9, not all the extras and all those other, there's all sorts of things that are part of that universe that I don't mean. But I remember I was introducing them to my children a number of years ago when we were in St. Lucia, and began to introduce them to Star Wars, and we watched them all the way through. But I remember as I was first approaching it, I wondered what the best way would be to work our way through this series, and I decided that the best way to do it was the same way that I did it. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? You don't start at number 1, right? We actually started at number 4 and watched 4, 5, 6, and then we went back to 1, 2, 3, and then 7, 8, 9. And those of you that haven't watched them, you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. But if you have watched them, you know exactly what I'm talking about, why you would do that. And we decided that for them, as we're introducing them to this world of Star Wars, that we're gonna take it out of order, but it's gonna be in context. It's gonna make sense to them as they watch it that way through. So we didn't watch it chronologically, but we kind of pick and chose some of them. And I say all that to say this, it's just a funny illustration, but sometimes we take the Gospels, we approach the Gospels that way, especially the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that when we hear stories, when someone tells you a story, when we watch through those movies, sometimes we like to hear that in chronological order, right? If somebody's telling you a story, it's this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then that happened, and we kind of work our way chronologically through the story. And that's how we like to hear stories, and that's often how we approach these Gospels. And of all the Gospels, these synoptic Gospels, Mark and Luke take the most chronological approach. So this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and they work their way through the ministry and the life of Christ on this earth. But Matthew, and I've mentioned this before, but I really was struck by this week, that Matthew doesn't take the same chronological approach to things as the other gospel writers do. He doesn't take things in that same. There are some things that still happen chronologically, but rather than doing that in his gospel, he takes themes and ideas and he places them together, even if they're out of chronological order. I don't know if you're following me at all this morning. It's too early in the morning, maybe, for some of this. But Matthew, instead of going in order, he takes these themes and puts them together, and he takes these teachings of Jesus and puts them all together. So sometimes it seems like when you come to the Gospels, there's this little bit of discrepancy, a little bit of contradiction when it comes to times and when things happen. But I just want you to be reminded of that as we work our way through Matthew. He doesn't have things out of order. He's just putting these things together. And I was especially reminded of that as I worked through these past few chapters and the passage that we're looking at this morning, that in these past couple chapters up until this morning, Matthew is really, he's building this argument that really comes to its full conclusion here this morning, this whole idea of the kingdom being an upside down kingdom where those that are valued least in this world have great values in the value in the eye of Jesus, right? That the last will be first and the first will be last. Matthew's been working that into these last couple of chapters. The world, we saw that the world devalues and discredits children and those with childlike faith. But Jesus said, don't forbid them. Suffer the little children to come to me. They may have little value at this point in the world's eyes, but they have great value to me. At the same time, the world would idolize and elevate this rich young ruler that comes to Jesus who had it all. Remember, he had all the power and money and position and youthfulness. He had all the things that the world would say, hey, these are things that you need to go after. And yet, though he was great in the world's eyes, he was least in the kingdom. He missed out on the kingdom because he couldn't get his values straight. Parable of the laborer we looked at last week continues that thought, that those who came first were worthy of the same that those who came last. And Jesus turned that around on its head, that the last shall be first and the first shall be last. And he bookends that parable with that thought. And Matthew is taking all of these teachings and accounts and parables and putting them together to teach us that God's kingdom is not like the kingdoms of this world. God's values are not the same as the values of this world. God's economy doesn't work the same way that our economy does. He doesn't value, he doesn't exalt the same things that we in this world exalt. God loves everyone, yes, but as Matthew says later, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. God's kingdom works differently. God has a way of turning things around and helping us focus our attention on what is right and what is real and what is eternal and what is truly valuable. And that's what we've seen through these chapters. And as Matthew closes out this chapter, and really as we come to the end of chapter 20, we begin a whole new section into the very last few weeks of Jesus' ministry and his life. He kind of finishes out his public ministry, and there's some more intense teaching there, but it really moves us into a new section. We see here in this passage this principle played out, both in a negative way with two of the disciples, but also in a positive way with a story, with an account here at the very end, the example of Jesus. And so I really want us this morning, as we come to this passage, as we bring all of these things together, it's the same thing we've really been looking at the last couple of weeks, but as we bring all of this together here this morning, I really want us to do some self-examination and see where our hearts really are. And just as we're looking at this, to examine yourself and see if your heart and your motives and your values really align with those of Christ and what he's teaching. So this passage is divided into three very clear sections. I'm sure you saw that as we read through it, but they're all dealing with the same thought. So let me give you the overarching principle here, the thought that Jesus is giving us, that Matthew is emphasizing, and then we'll look at how each one of these three sections lines up and aligns with that thought. So the main thought this morning as we go through this passage is simply this: greatness in God's kingdom comes through a life of humility and service. Greatness in God's kingdom, the thing that God values as greatness, is humility and service. And we'll see as we go through that each one of these three sections lines up and shows us that and teaches us that. That's the point that Jesus has been trying to get across the last couple chapters. The last shall be first. The first shall be last. Come to this place of humility and service, that God's kingdom is upside down from what the world's kingdom looks like. His values are different. His principles are different. And that's what Matthew is trying to get across. So we're going to look at these three different sections. So notice, first of all, Jesus' death is the ultimate example of this upside down kingdom. Jesus' death is the ultimate example of this teaching that Jesus is trying to get across. And we see that in verse 17 and 19. Jesus is going up to Jerusalem, and he took the 12 disciples apart in the way and saith unto them, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him, and the third day he shall rise again. So Matthew is telling us that Jesus is now on his way to Jerusalem. He's finished with his ministry in Galilee, Capernaum, in that area. He's walking towards Jerusalem. He's going to spend a bit of time there. There's going to be a little more teaching that he gives his disciples. But in reality, this trip, this journey that Jesus is taking to Jerusalem is coming. It's leading to the culmination of Jesus' ministry. It's leading to the end. It's coming to a close. And Jesus knows that. He knows there's not a whole lot of time left. He knows what's awaiting him in Jerusalem. So for the fourth time, he comes to his disciples and he takes them apart and he says, Listen, I am going to be betrayed to the chief priests and the scribes. And they are going to condemn me to death. I mean, Jesus is pretty clear now in foretelling his death, in predicting his death. They're going to betray me. One is going to betray me to the chief priests. The religious leaders are not going to be convinced of who I am. They're not going to turn. They're not going to change their mind. They're not going to repent. They will condemn me. They'll turn me over to the Gentiles, and I am going to suffer. They're going to scourge me and crucify me. He says to his disciples, look, we're going to Jerusalem, but I want you to know that it's to my death we're going. There's some suffering that is ahead for me. But again, he says, just so you understand, that suffering, that death isn't permanent. It's not the end. I will be crucified and I will be put in a grave. But listen, I won't be staying there. I'll be there for a short period of time. But that grave, death, won't be able to hold me. On the third day, he says, I will rise again. And he clearly is telling his disciples what is to come is death, burial, and a resurrection. Now you might think and wonder this morning why Matthew is putting that in the middle of this passage at this point in time. Right in between the parable of the laborers and the request of James and John and their mother. Why does Matthew put that prediction there? Remember, he's not doing things chronologically. He's putting things together. So why this at this time? And I think there's a good purpose for that. It's not an accident that Jesus' prediction of his suffering and death and resurrection follows immediately after the principle that the first shall be last and the last shall be first. Right? He told of his humiliation, of his betrayal, the humiliation of betrayal, his mockings, the beatings he would endure, the death and burial, both at the hands of the religious leaders and the Gentile leaders. He's telling them of all of this suffering that is to come. Now listen, Jesus, just think about who Jesus is. Jesus, the one who is and was and is to come. Jesus, the one who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature. Jesus, the creator and sustainer. The one who is before all things and whom and by all things, by him all things consist. Jesus, the one who has the preeminence. The one who is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. The way, the truth, and the life. The one who is supremely first over creation. That one, that Jesus, was going to submit himself to being treated as the very lowest of all criminals. The death of the cross. By the way, this is the first specific mention of the crucifixion, which the crucifixion was a punishment of ultimate humiliation, reserved only for the most despised criminals. Jesus just said the first is going to be last. And here is an example of the one who is overall being treated and subjected to the treatment of the very lowest of them all. But then, out of the lastness of apparent defeat, the king would rise triumphant over death. The last will be first. Philippians 2, verses 5 through 11, we won't look at it all, but it really explains this in greater detail. The one who became obedient even unto the death of the cross, the one who submitted himself to that ultimate humiliation and betrayal and beating and the suffering of the cross, the death of the cross, would be the one whom God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. The one who was made low was going to be exalted to the place where every knee would bow and every tongue would confess that he is Lord. Jesus is the greatest example of the first being last and the last being first. Listen, here's the point. What Jesus is calling us to in these verses, and we'll get into that in just a second. this place of humility and service and selflessness. He didn't just teach about it. He was the greatest example of it. He demonstrated it. Now, it's amazing to me that, again, this is the fourth time that Jesus has said this, and his disciples still don't get it. They don't understand. But he's about to show them what he means. He's about to demonstrate this servanthood. Let me just make this quick application. It's not easy to humble ourselves to this place that we might consider to be lowly servanthood. There are some people that it's really hard to serve. You know, even this is true even as a pastor. There are people that are easy to minister to, and there are people that are more difficult to minister to. As you serve people, there are people that are easy to serve, and there are people that are more difficult to serve. You know that. You understand that. But when Jesus talks about being a servant, he doesn't differentiate between those two different types of people. There may be people that are hard to serve. But if Jesus went all the way to the cross for the sake of you and I, if the one who is first gave his life a ransom for all, if Christ can make that kind of sacrifice, then so can I. If he can give us that kind of example, then I can do the same. See, Jesus' servanthood is the foundation and example for my servanthood. He demonstrated it. He deserved, listen, Jesus deserved all the glory and all the honor that humanity could give him. He deserved it all and even more. But instead, he laid that aside. He thought of you and I. He served us. And as we experience that, it should transform us to the place where we can serve anybody around us. Because if Jesus can do that for me, then I can do that for somebody else. I can have that same kind of servanthood. I can have that same kind of example. So Jesus gives them this example, and it's amazing to me what happens in the very next couple verses. Jesus has just been teaching about the first and the last being first, the first being last. He tells them, listen, I'm about to go to Jerusalem, and I'm about to suffer. I'm about to give my life. And then in the very next verse, the disciples begin to argue over greatness. The disciples begin to argue, and we won't read all of it again, but in verse 20 to 28, you find this conversation that Jesus is having with the mother of James and John, and Mark tells us with James and John themselves. They're there asking the question. So Mark tells us in his account that after Jesus predicts his suffering and death and resurrection, he adds this. He says, and the disciples understood none of this. They didn't get it. It went over their heads. Maybe it didn't go over their heads, but it went in one ear and out the other. They heard Jesus saying, I'm going to suffer, I'm going to die, I'm going to rise again, but they didn't understand. They didn't get it. And you can tell they didn't get it by their response. So here in this passage, the mother of James and John come to Jesus, the wife of Zebedee. And lest you think she was alone in this, Mark also tells us that James and John were also involved in this conversation. It was actually their ambition. It was their desire. It was their question. Mark says that they come to Jesus and say, this is James and John, that they come to Jesus and say, Lord, we would that thou shouldest do for us whatsoever we desire. In other words, they come to Jesus and say, listen, Jesus, we want you to do for us whatever we want. There's something that we want from you, and you should do it for us. That's what they say to Jesus. And here in Matthew, the mother of James and John comes, and she worships Jesus in verse number 20, and desiring a certain thing of him, she desires something for her children. And Jesus says in verse 21, what wilt thou? In other words, what do you want? What is it that you're asking for? What is your desire? And she says, and I'm going to paraphrase what she says here. I can kind of picture this conversation happening in my mind. But she's thinking this way, Lord, you just finished saying, excuse me, that the disciples are going to rule with you. Right? That was the end of the last passage last week. That, remember, Peter said, we've given up all to follow you. What's in it for us? And Jesus says, you're going to rule with me. There's going to be thrones that you're going to sit on. And so they hear that. And the mother of James and John says, listen, you said that my sons are going to rule with you. That you're going to sit on a throne. And there's going to be 12 thrones around you. And they're all going to rule with you. I heard you say that. So what I want is this. I want one of my boys to sit on your left hand and one of my other boys to sit on your right hands. Like, they're all going to rule with you, but I want them to sit right next to you. I want James right there on your right and John right there, or James on your right, John on your left, or maybe the other way around. But I want my boys to sit. I want my boys to have that place of power and authority and position and greatness in the kingdom. That's what I want for them. I don't know if you've ever coached any sports, but to me, it's like having that parent come up to you as you're coaching, or that mom or dad, and they come up as you're coaching and they say, listen, I don't know why you have my child playing batting last. He's a better hitter than that, or she's a better hitter. She should probably move up in the order. And they seem to be playing out in the outfield a lot. I'd like them to play on the infield. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but it's like, I want my son or my daughter to have that best place on the team. They should be hitting number three. They should be hitting cleanup. Or they should be in a better position. Or maybe as a teacher, having a parent come to you and saying, I don't know why you gave my child a D on this test. He definitely deserved an A. He put a lot of work into that. I think you've made a mistake. They need a better position. You're not treating them properly. Now, it's amazing. Jesus just said, I'm going to Jerusalem to die. And she's like, yeah, but can my son sit by you? Like, it just went in one ear and right out the other. Did you even hear at all what Jesus just said? Have you grasped anything that he's been trying to teach? And I think about that question, I'm like, what are you thinking? But the more I think on that, the more I understand that there's a little bit of all of us in her, in that question. But sometimes we're more worried about our reputation and what other people think of us and what we deserve, what other people say of us, and we're more worried about our position and our power and our authority than we are about fulfilling the Great Commission. And we're the same way. It's more about what I can get than it is about doing what God desires me to do, of following the example of Jesus, who gave everything. He gave his life for a ransom. So there's a little bit of all of us, I think, in her as she comes and asks this question. I think these words, this question, shows that they failed to understand the gravity and the seriousness of what Jesus had just taught. It went right by them. They literally made the mistake that Jesus was just teaching about in the previous verses. They were assuming that greatness in the kingdom was based on power and authority and rank and position, and they wanted that for themselves. Now again, it's interesting, Jesus doesn't rebuke them, just like he did with Peter when he asked the question, what's in it for me? He doesn't rebuke them, but he says to them, he in verse 22, you don't know what you're asking for. And he asked them a question, are you able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of and to be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? You're asking for something, but you don't really understand what you're asking for. You don't really know what you're looking for, because if you knew, you wouldn't have asked. The cup, as it's used there, often when you see the word the cup used in that way in Scripture, it's It often represents suffering and judgment. Often you'll see it as the cup of God's wrath. There's a number of Old Testament places that you'll find that. And the idea of that cup of the baptism that he was going to be baptized with, he's talking about his coming suffering. What he just told them was going to happen when he goes to Jerusalem. He's still pointing them to his death and his burial and his suffering, but they're not connecting it. They're saying, we're ready to rule. We're ready to fight with you if need be to bring in the kingdom. We're ready to suffer if need be. Jesus said, are you able to do this? And it's amazing. They answer, they say to him, they don't even know what they're saying, but they say, we are able. We can do that. We can suffer if need be to bring in the kingdom. If that means we get to rule, then I'll suffer a little bit. They don't understand what Jesus is telling them. And Jesus says to them, you know what? You will suffer. You will drink of the same cup that I drink of. You will be baptized with the same baptism that I am baptized with. And they did. Church history tells us that James was martyred for his faith. He did suffer for Jesus. He did drink of that cup of suffering. John was exiled. They suffered greatly. Jesus knew that was coming. He said, you will suffer the same way that I suffer, but to sit on my right hand or my left hand, that's not mine to give. That's the Father's job. Now, it's interesting here in verse 24, Matthew says, when the 10 heard it, they were pleased with the question. Is that what it says? You know what, James and John, you deserve those seats. You guys have followed Jesus. You're examples to us all. You should sit on the left and right. I think that's a great... No, they didn't think that way. When the disciples heard it, Matthew tells us that they were moved with indignation. Man, they were angry at James and John. That word indignation, it's more than just being angry. It's actually having the idea of being upset at a perceived wrong against myself. Like somebody has wronged me and I'm mad at it. That's the idea of that word indignation, that they felt that question from James and John personally grieved them. It was against them. That wrong was done to them. This was more than just pure anger here. This was wounded pride. What do you mean you're asking for those places? We should have those places. What makes you better than us? You know, they also wanted those positions, but they just couldn't imagine themselves asking for them. See, if the disciples had really learned Jesus' lesson on humility, they would have had no pride to wound. But they didn't, and their pride was wounded. I think the other 10 are probably just sorry that they didn't ask first, because they wanted those positions. And so Jesus takes this opportunity to teach them just a little more on the kingdom. I want you to see just two things here quickly. First of all, notice the world's view of leadership. He says in verse 25, he calls them over and said, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. You know, the world sees greatness. The world sees leadership as power over people. That the more power you have, the greater you are, the better leader you are. You say, how do you know that? This is how you know. Give somebody a position of power and see what happens. Give somebody a position of authority and see how they handle that. The world loves to exercise that kind of power and that kind of authority over other people. Leaders in this world seek control and status and personal gain. And by the way, you even see this in the church sometimes, that leaders desire to have that control over the people and that status. They want everybody to know who they are and that personal gain. We see this played out all the time. You see it in the church, you see it in politics, you see it in business, that people enjoy lording their authority and power over other people. I have status. This is my position, my authority. That's how the world looks at it. That's what Jesus says. But he says, this should not be so with you. This is not my view of leadership. It should not be so among you. What is the kingdom's view of leadership? He says this, but whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and give his life a ransom for many. What Jesus does here is he redefines what greatness is. Greatness in God's kingdom is not measured by name or authority or rank or power or position. Greatness in God's kingdom is ranked by humility and service. That is greatness. Those that are able to humble themselves and serve others, that is greatness. The world says, hey, climb that ladder. Jesus says, go lower. Serve others. If you want to be great in the eyes of God, then start at the very bottom. Start with humility and sacrifice and serve one another. Listen, didn't Jesus give us the greatest example of this? I was thinking specifically of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords getting on his knees just before his death and washing the feet of his disciples. That was the job of a slave. But Jesus did it joyfully. Jesus taught us that serving others, listen, serving others is not beneath us. It is the highest calling that we have. And in verse 28, he gives us the ultimate example of giving his life a ransom for many. I'll come back to that quickly in just a moment, but I want to see just thirdly and really quickly this third section. And we won't spend much time here, but Jesus demonstrates servanthood to the least. These blind men calling out to Jesus. And the multitude say to them, be quiet, let him be. But they begin to cry even louder, saying, Lord, have mercy on us. And Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? I'm paraphrasing here really quickly. What do you want me to do for you? And say, Lord, open our eyes that we can see. And he has compassion on them and heals them. And they receive their sight. And I think Matthew puts this account, again, we're taking things out of chronological order and putting them together. And I think he puts this here for a couple of reasons. I think, first of all, that this account of these blind men being healed bookends this whole teaching that Jesus has been giving on the last being first and the first being last. Those that are low in this world's eyes are valuable in the eyes of Jesus. Remember at the beginning of this section, some children are brought to Jesus and the disciples say, send them away. And Jesus says, no, don't send them away. Let them come. And then at the very end of this teaching, these blind men come to Jesus and the multitude say, send them away. And Jesus says, no, let them come. They're valuable to me. Jesus sees them and has compassion on them and opens their eyes. And there's a pattern here from the very beginning to the very end of the greatest serving the least, the first ministering to the last in the world's eyes. And Jesus over and over and over and over again demonstrates this principle, this idea of servanthood, reaching out to those who are despised and rejected by the world, the children, the blind, the poor, the broken, the sinners. Jesus came to seek and to save that which was lost. We keep seeing this pattern of Jesus as an ultimate servant, reaching those that the world despises. But then I think it's also here because we see a great contrast between James and John and their mother and these two blind men as they call out to Jesus. Because he actually asked them both the same question. He asked the mother of James and John and the blind man the same question. What do you want me to do for you? What do you want me to do for you? And the answer is quite different. Right? James and John are looking for position and power and authority and control and comfort and convenience. They want what is rightfully theirs. But these blind men ask for mercy. Lord, show mercy on us. Open our eyes that we can see. Listen, if Jesus were to ask you that question this morning, what do you want from me? What is it that I can do for you? What would your answer be? What do you want me to do for you? I think the reality in my own life is this: I'm often a lot more selfish than I'd like to admit. That if I were asked that question, I might think, well, what do I need? What is it that I can have? And yet Jesus keeps giving us this example of servanthood, serving the least, the first serving the last. See, the world says, be important, be great, achieve greatness in your life, get what's yours. Jesus says, be a servant. Serve others, sacrifice for others. The world says, make a name for yourself. But Jesus says, humble yourself. The world says, climb to the top. Do whatever you need to get there. Jesus says, go to the bottom. Listen, true greatness, I heard someone say this once, true greatness is not how many people serve you. True greatness is how many people you serve. That's what greatness is. So let me ask you this in closing, as we finish up, just a practical question that we can take this and we can examine ourselves and really see where we are. The question is this: who are you serving? Who are you serving? This servanthood should be happening in all the different areas of our life. It should be happening in the church. Listen, if you're not serving in the church, then get involved. Get serving. God's given you gifts that you can serve other people in the church. It should be happening in the home. Spouses serving each other, not looking to get our own needs met, but meeting the needs of our spouse, of those in the home. Parents and children serving each other. You know, friction comes in the home when we're more worried about ourselves and what we deserve than we are worried about meeting the needs of others. In the home. It should be happening in the home. It should be happening in the community. It's a lot easier to serve people in the church and people that we love than it is to serve people who are difficult and hard to love. Do you have a way that you are serving people in this community, in your neighborhood? Are you building those kind of gospel relationships where you are demonstrating the love of Christ and the servanthood of Christ in the community? Should be happening in church, at home, in the community, at work. This is my challenge as we finish up. We'll close with this. I want you to take all of those areas, and you can do this on your own. The church, at home, you throw in at work, in our community. Take all of those different areas and write out some ways that you can practically serve somebody this week. How can I serve somebody at home? How can I serve somebody at church? How can I serve someone in my community? Take it, write it down. Here's some ways that I can practically serve, and then do it. Live it out. It's not about recognition. It's not about convenience. Service comes from a heart of love, a heart of worship. I'm going to do this because Jesus did it, and I love him, and I want to obey him. Listen, if you don't know what to write or what to put down, then ask God. He'll show you. He'll show you ways that you can serve people. Write it down out of a heart of love for the Lord and for people that he loves. Serve others. He'll show you. Start small, but do it. Let's have the same attitude and humility and heart of service as Jesus had, and love people in that way.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. My prayer is that God would use the preaching of his word in your life in a special way. If there's any way that we can be a help to you, please feel free to reach out at bibcinfo@gmail.com. Or if you're in the area, you're always welcome to come join us in worshiping the Lord together every Sunday morning at 10 o'clock and Wednesday at 6:30. May the Lord bless you today.